Blog Talk Radio.
Hey, good evening. This is Elias Dill. Tonight, we're going to do a shorter essay. I don't know if we'll get. I think we're going to get through it tonight. That's only a few pages, about 4 or 5 pages long. It's a little known essay by Ralph Waldo Emerson. It was written in, dated January 1842 when he wrote it. And it's from his, it's Emerson, for those of you who may or may not know, was a very prolific writer. And he began the school of transcendentalism. And his writings are go without mention in most academic circles of spiritual. I'm sorry, a little frog in my throat tonight. It goes without saying, he was probably one of the most prolific and brilliant writers of his time and the 1800s and the 19th century. And he's still considered by many and by me to be one of the most profound writers over the last 1,000 years, possibly in the last 2,000 years. But he definitely speaks, he's a timeless writer, because he taps into the soul of man. He taps into the essence of what we are. He transcends, and as a transcendentalist, he talks about the transcendence of man into the and crossing over, basically, or crossing into the soul, understanding the spiritual laws that govern mankind, and basically govern the universe. Those laws are not like man's laws. These are universal laws. These are laws that transcend the average thought, and they're just profound. But nevertheless, this is an interesting interesting essay, and one I'd like to bring to you tonight. It's called The Senses and the Soul. And I'll begin. And if there's time, I'll discuss this a little further toward the end of the program. What we know, now again, I wanted to put this in the time frame that it was written so that it could explain some of the language that he used, grammatical style of the time. But he wrote this in January of 1842. What we know is a point to what we do not know. The first questions are still to be asked. Let any man bestow a thought on himself, how he came hither and whither he tends, and he will find that all the literature, all the philosophy that is on record have done little to dull the edge of inquiry. The globe that swims so silently with us through the sea of space has never a port, but with its little convoy of friendly orbs pursues its voyage through the signs of heaven to renew its navigation again forever. The wonderful tidings Our glasses and calendars give us, concerning the hospitable lights that hang around us in the deep, do not appease, but inflame our curiosity. And in like manner, our culture does not lead to any goal, but its richest results of thought and action are only new preparation. I'm going to just interject this because I appreciate how he does this, and I so admire how he works this world, this fourth and fifth, sixth dimensional message, okay, into such a concise yet unlimited expanse of thought within that small paragraph. Here on the surface of our swimming earth, we come out of silence into society already formed, into language, customs, and traditions ready-made, and the multitude of our associates discountenance us from expressing any surprise at the somewhat agreeable novelty of being, and frown down any intimation on our part of a disposition to assume our own vows, to preserve our independence, and to institute any inquiry into the sweet and sublime vision which surrounds us. And that's so true. That's so true. We have a tendency to take so much for granted and then scoff at anyone who sees something new in our society, in our relationship with the universe, with nature, with ourselves, with our peers, with our family, within the realm of human existence. But yet we're souls having a human experience, you know, and that's so very true. And yet there seems no need that any should fear we should go too wise, we should grow too wise. The path of truth has obstacles enough of its own. We dwell on the surface of nature. We dwell amidst surfaces, and surface laps so closely on surface that we cannot easily pierce to see the interior organism. Then the subtlety of things. Under every cause, another cause. Truth soars too high or dives too deep for the most resolute inquirer. See of how much we know nothing. See the strange position of man. Our science neither comprehends him as a whole nor any one of its particulars. See the action and reaction of will and necessity. See his passions and their origin in the deeps of nature and circumstance. See the fear that rides even the brave. See the omnipresent hope whose fountains in our consciousness no metaphysician can find. Consider the phenomenon of laughter and explore the elements of the comet. What do we know of the mystery of music? And what of form? Why this stroke? This outline should express beauty and that another, and that other not. See the occult region of demonology, with its coincidence, foresight, dreams, and omens. Consider the appearance of death, the formidable secret of our destiny, looming up as the barrier of knowledge. Our ignorance is great enough, and yet the fact most surprising is not our ignorance, but the adversation of men from knowledge. That which one would say would unite all minds and join all hands, the ambition to push as far as fate would permit the planted garden of man on every hand into the kingdom of night, really fires the heart of few and solitary men. Tell men to study themselves, and for the most part, they find nothing less interesting. Whilst we walk environed before and behind with will, fate, hope, fear, love, and death, these phantoms or angels whom we catch at but cannot embrace, it is droll to see the contentment and incuriosity of man. All take for granted, the learned as well as the unlearned, that a great deal, nay, almost all, is known and forever settled. But in truth, all is now to be... But in truth, all is now to be begun, and every new mind ought to take the attitude of Columbus, launch out from the gaping loiterers on the shore, and sail west for a new world. This profound ignorance, this deep sleep of the higher faculties of man, coexists with a great abundance of what are called the means of learning, great activity of bookmaking and of formal teaching. Go into one of our public libraries when a new box of books and journals have arrived with the usual importation of a periodical literature of England. The best names of Britain are on the covers, but a mass of literary production for a single week or month. We speculate upon it before we read. We say, what an invention is the press and the journal by which 100 pale students, each a hive of distilled flowers of learning, of thought, each a poet, each an accomplished man whom the selectest influences have joined to breed and enrich, are made to unite their manifold streams for the information and delight of everybody who can read. How lame is speech? How imperfect the communication of the ancient harper, wandering from castle to hamlet to sing to a vagrant audience his melodious thoughts. These unopened books contain the chosen verses of 100 minstrels born, living, and singing in distant countries in different languages. For the intellectual wealth of the world, like its commercial rolls to London, and through that great heart is hurled again to the extremities. And here, too, is the result, not poetic, of how much thought, how much experience, and how much suffering of wise and cultivated men. How can we in America expect books of our own, whilst the bale of wisdom arrives once or twice in a month at our ports? In this mind, we open the books and begin to read. We find that the books about books, we find they are books about books, and then perhaps the book criticized was itself a compilation or digest of others, so that the pages we read is at third or fourth hand from the event or sentiment which it describes. Then we find that much the largest proportion of the pages relates exclusively to matters of fact, the superficial fact, and as if the system systematically shuns any reference to a thought or law which the fact dictated. Now that's fascinating, because he wrote this in 1842, of course, long before television was ever invented or the internet or things we take for granted today. But isn't he really describing the mainstream media today? The mainstream media being books three articles that came from England. He's saying there's so little news from really books written from the United States at that time. So much of what they learned or so much of what they read were third and fourth hand reports of books that were unavailable in America, okay, or rare, you know, rare finds. So that's what we say, not today. Now, the news gatherers of today, gather news that is accessible, but they make up their news. Their news media reports the same news on all the same stations, and it's reported by writers and readers who simply read the news. They don't report anything. They just read it off monitors. So this is where we're getting it. So there's nothing from the original source, the original writers, or the original A large part, again, both of the prose and verse is gleanings from old compositions, and the oft-repeated praise of such is repeated in the praise of the present day. We have even the mortification to find one more deduction still from our anticipated prize, namely that a large portion of ostentatious criticism is merely a hired advertisement of the great booksellers. Same thing today as, as happens everywhere. Booksellers put out, criticisms or reviews in periodicals and newspapers. All right. And we read them as though they were fact, when actually they're nothing more than a promotion. In the course of our turning of leaves, we fall at last on an extraordinary passage. A record of thought and virtue, or a clarion strain of poetry, or perchance a traveler makes us acquainted with strange modes of life in some relic of primeval religion, or rarer yet, a profound sentence is here printed, shines here new but eternal for these linen pages. We wonder whence it came, or perhaps trace it instantly home, to the only head it could come from. A few thoughts are all we glean from the best inspection of the paper pile. All the rest is combination and confectionery. A little part abides in our memory, and goes to exalt the sense of duty and make us happier. For the rest, our heated expectation is chilled and disappointed. Some indirect benefit will no doubt accrue if we read, embrace an active mind, if we read with braced and active mind, we learn this negative fact, itself a piece of human life. We contrast this mountain of dross with the grains of gold. We oversee the writer and learn somewhat of the laws of writing, but a lesson as good we might be learning elsewhere. Now it is true of a month's or a year's issue of new books seems to me, with a little qualification, true of the age. The stock writers, for the honesty of the literary class, has given this population a name, vastly outnumbering the thinking men. One man, two men, possibly three or four men, have cast behind them the long descended costume of the academy and the expectations of fashion, and have said, "This world is too fair. This world comes home no near, too near to me, than that I should walk a stranger in it and live a second hand, fed by other men's doctrines or treading only in their steps. I feel a higher right herein and will hearken to the oracle myself." Such have perceived the extreme poverty of literature, have seen that there was not and could not be help for the fervent soul except through its own energy. But the great number of those who have voluminously ministered to the popular tastes were men of talents who have some feat, who had some feat which each could do with words, but who have not added to wisdom or to virtue. Talent amuses. Wisdom instructs. Talent shows me what other men can do. Genius acquaints me with the spacious circuits of a common nature. One is carpentry, the other is growth. To take a step into the world of thought is now given to us, is now given to but few men. Let me repeat that because it's so important. To make a step into the world of thought is now given to but few men. To make a second step beyond the first, only one in a country can do. But to carry the thought on to three steps marks a great teacher. Aladdin's palace, with its one unfinished window, which all the gems in the royal treasury cannot finish in the style of the meanest of the profusion of jeweled windows that were built by the genie in a night, is but too true an image of the efforts of talent to add one verse to the copious text which inspiration writes by one or another scribe from age to age. It is not that the literary class or those for whom they write are not lovers of truth and amenable to principles. All are so. The hunger of men for truth is immense, but they are not erect on their feet. The senses are too strong for the soul. Our senses barbarize us. When the ideal world recedes before the senses, we are on a retrograde march. The savage surrenders to his senses. He is subject to paroxysms of joy and fear. He is lewd and a drunkard. The equinox in the exhilaration of the morning sun, when he is invigorated by sleep, will sell his bed. He is the fool of the moment's sensations to the degree of losing sight of the whole amount of his sensations in so many years. And there is an equinox in every man which makes us believe in the permanence of this moment's state of our game more than our own experience will warrant. That's rather a difficult sentence, but all he's saying is that we are so wrapped up in our senses, in this third dimensional world. I mean, we touch, we feel, we see, we hear, you know, and smell, and that is the extent of our experience, but it is so pleasurable and so temporarily sustaining, but yet temporarily satisfying, that we lose sight of our soul. We lose sight of who we actually are. We lose sight of our spiritual selves and become absorbed in the third dimensional or the sensual world. And I wish to repeat this phrase. And there is an equinox in every man which makes us believe in the permanence of this moment state of our game more than our own experience will warrant. In the fine day, we despise the house. At sea, the passengers always judge from the weather of the present moment of the probable length of the voyage. In a fresh breeze, they are sure of a good run. Becalmed, they are equally sure of a long passage. In trade, the momentary state of the markets betrays continually the experience and long-sightedness, and long-sighted. In politics and in our opinion of the prospects of society, we are in like manner the slaves of the hour. Meet one or two malignant disclaimers, and we are weary of life and distrust the permanence of good institutions. A single man in a ragged coat at an election looks revolutionary. But a ride in a stagecoach with one or two benevolent persons and good spirits, and the Republic seems to us safe. It is but an extension of the despotism, of sense. One second here. Shall I say only a calculated sensuality? A little more comprehensive devotion which subjugates the eminent and the reputed wise and hinders an ideal culture. In the great stakes which the leaders of society esteem, not at all fanciful but solid in the best reputed professions and operations, what is there which will bear the scrutiny of reason? Make sure that I... This book has very, very thin pages. Make sure I didn't skip a page here. Again, in a little more comprehensive devotion, which subjugates the eminent and the reputed wise and hinders an ideal culture. In the great stakes which the leaders of society esteem not at all fanciful but solid, in the best reputed professions and operations, what is there which will bear the scrutiny of reason? The most active lives have so much routine as to preclude progress almost equally with the most inactive. It's fascinating. The most active lives have so much routine as to preclude progress almost equally with the most inactive. So the most active, but yet most routined and most disciplined person almost has the same progress in his life as the most inactive person, because he never really goes beyond his routine. And we defer to the noted merchants whose influence is felt not only in their native cities, but in most parts of the globe. But our respect does them and ourselves great injustice, for their trade is without system. Their affairs unfold themselves after no law of the mind, but are bubble built on bubble, without end. A world of arithmetic, not of commerce. Much less of considerate humanity. They add voyage to voyage and buy stocks that they may buy stocks, and no ulterior purpose is thought of. When you see their dexterity in the particulars, you cannot overestimate the resources of good sense, and when you find how empty they are of all remote aims, you cannot underestimate their philosophy. The men of letters and the professions we have charged with the like surrender to routine. It is no otherwise with the men of office. Statesmen are solitary. As no time do they form a class. Governments, for the most part, are carried on by political merchants, quite without principle, and according to the maxims of trade and huckster. So that what is true of merchants is true of public officers. Why should we suffer ourselves to be cheated by sounding names and fair shows? The titles, the property, their notoriety, the brief consequence of our fellows are only the decoration of the sacrifice and add to the melancholy of the observer. The earth goes on, the earth glittering with gold. The earth goes to the earth sooner than it should. The earth builds on the earth's castles and towers. The earth says to the earth, all this is ours. All this is covered up by the speedy succession of the particulars, which tread so close on each other's heels. our heel as to allow no space for the man to question the whole thing. There is somewhat terrific in this mask of routine. Captain Franklin, after 6 weeks traveling on the ice to the North Pole, found himself 200 miles south of the spot he had set out from. The ice had floated, and we sometimes start to think we are spelling out the same sentences, saying the same words, repeating the same acts as in former years. Our ice may float also. This preponderance of the senses can be balanced and this preponderance of the senses can we balance and redress. This preponderance of the senses, can we balance and redress? Can we give permanence to the lightings of the thought, can we give permanence to the lightings of thought which lick up in a moment these combustible mountains of sensation and custom and reveal the moral order after which the world is to be rebuilt anew? Grave questions, truly, but such as leave us no option. To know the facts is already a choosing of sides, ranges us on the party of the light and reason, sounds the signal for the strife and prophecies, an end to the insanity, and a restoration of the balance and rectitude of man. I want to repeat the last sentence. To know the facts is already a choosing of sides, ranges us on the party of light and reason, sounds the signal for the strife, and prophecies in an end to the insanity, and a restoration of the balance and rectitude of man. And I think that's the end of the essay. But I think we have to understand the essence of this. And it's a rather difficult one to read. In the sense that it, as much of Edmondson's work, it is so expansive in its scope, symbolic, and the man works on two levels of thought continually in his work, on the spiritual and on the physical, and constantly relating the two to each other, and trying to equate his reader to both the soul and the senses, and he does this in all of his work. For instance, in the Oversoul, one of his greatest works. I actually did a reading. It's in my archives, The Oversoul, and so many other essays that I've read by Emerson on this program. But we have to understand with Emerson's writings that, I may not be the most knowledgeable Emersonian, even though I claim the name. I don't think follow him. was a minister. He started off as a Calvinist minister. That was, and he gave that up. He thought that was, he gave it up when he was in his, I believe, early, very early 30s. He was a trained Calvinist minister. But he didn't believe in that any longer. He felt that that was not his calling, and that the world and God, if you will, and nature were far, far, far greater in concept than Calvinism or basically any religion held. So Emerson basically set out on his own to find God in his own way, and to create
out of thought, interior spree, spire,
fear, and for out of thought's interior sphere, these wonders rose to upper air, and nature gladly gave them place, adopted them into her race, granted them an equal date with Andes and with Ararat. And these temples grew as grows the grass. Art might obey, but not surpass. The passive master lent his hand to the vast soul that o'er him planned. And the same power that reared the shrine bestowed the tribes that knelt within. And ever the fiery Pentecost girds, and one flame the countless host trances the heart through chanting choirs, and through the priest the mind inspires. The words upon the prophet spoken was unto the prophet spoken was writ on tables yet unbroken. The word of seers or sibyls told in groves of oak or fanes of gold still float upon the morning wind, still whispered to the willing mind. One accent of the Holy Ghost the heedless world hath never lost. I know what say the fathers wise. The book itself before me lies. Chrysostom, best Augustine, and he who blent both in his line the younger golden lips of minds, Taylor, the Shakespeare of divines. His words are music in my ear. I see his cowled portrait near, and yet for all his faith could see, I would not the good bishop. And that was a problem that he had explaining his own problems with the church, problems with his career path, problems with being a preacher, problems with being held in to a dogma or an ideology that he didn't truly agree with, or had problems with, and thus the name of the poem is called The Problem. I have a problem. I don't deal with this. We all have that problem, you know. I can't fit into this this uniform life here that we talk about. And again, I think that was a good follow-up poem to the soul, the senses, and the soul. What a great problem with trying to fit in, trying to make your mind fit in to the third dimensional mundane reality that exists for all of us that we live in, without the ability or without the curiosity to transcend the thoughts and possibly sit for a moment and think of what it would be to be outside of yourself, outside of your daily routine, outside of that for a moment. And, you know, what it would be like to be somewhere else, something else. What if the world was bigger, better, or a place to live? What, you know, we don't take the time to think of these things because we're so involved with our third dimensional existence, with our senses, you know. We have an itch we have to scratch. We have a pain we have to relieve it. You know, and these are things that are demanded of us by being within this physical realm. However, that again is a problem because by our diversion of our attention by the senses, the soul is distracted from its original destiny, from its original state. We are a spirit having a human existence, you know, going through a human experience. But I can say that again and again because I believe that to be so true. Because if we look upon our lives as merely transient, a transient period where we are experiencing 50 years or 60 years or 100 years of time in a time of through eternity, because essentially the soul is immortal. And if we believe that we have an immortal soul, then this time that we are in here is simply here as an amusement, all right, for that soul. We may have been here time and time again, karma. We may have been reincarnated to achieve certain things within this dimension, to learn or to teach or to inspire or to create something new, something fresh. And the spirit for that moment, for that, you know, says, okay, well, there are so many spirits in need down there, is lost, and constantly within the undergoing the wheel of sorrow, the Buddhist concept of the samsara wheel, where we constantly are reincarnated back into the same mundane existence and never being able to learn any more than we did prior. So we are lost and trapped within this dimension of mundane experience, unable to release our souls. For instance, there's a theory that's known to many is that there are souls that are trapped, that cannot go forward, cannot go beyond. They, even though they're in a fourth dimensional state, when they die, when they pass on, they still don't see it. They still refuse to move onward because they don't understand they don't have the ability or they don't have the understanding to move forward. So what happens is they come back and try to regain that whatever it is they need in order, that wisdom, in order to find their way out. It's a eternal, it can be an eternal trap here in this dimension. Until the soul understands its own power and understands what it's supposed to be or what it is, rather than being deluded into believing that it has limited abilities, that it is a marginal and minimal fragment of existence. Like one of the worst songs ever written was "Dust in the Wind." You know, that was like, you know, that was probably the most nihilistic, negative, most suicidal song ever written. All we are is dust in the wind. I mean, God, you know, to that to be the theme song of a generation is really a horrible thing to plague mankind with. However, it's that atheistic, nihilistic attitude that really keeps mankind in the doldrums of his existence, you know. of third dimensional existence rather than being a great being able to expand to the height that he's capable of, or that a human being is capable of achieving. Instead, he's ground down by his own, by those who manipulate them, by those who profit by their own by others' ignorance. All right? Being able to herd people, like corporations herd people, like governments herd people into voting for an idiot candidate or buy some poisonous product or you know, they need this underarm deodorant to smell like you know, whatever, a flower, you know, or they need the toothpaste so that you can poison yourself with fluoride, you know, marketing and this psycho propaganda that just keeps perpetrating the human existence, you know, to the point where humanity, the individual, no longer can think for himself. And that's what Emerson has been trying to say. He says this all the time. Self-reliance and all of it, you know, all of his works. Think for yourself. Be a thinker. Be a critical thinker. Be a free thinker. You know, run the risk of being a madman, but be a free thinker. Right? And don't let somebody, you know, convince you of something else. Don't let somebody drive you by fear or by your own ignorance. Learn, study, research. Make up your own mind. Don't let somebody else make it up for you. Okay? And don't be afraid to criticize, for God's sakes. If you see something that's wrong or doesn't make sense to you, don't be afraid to say so. Say, this doesn't make any sense. This, you know, the Obama administration is a failed administration. The Bush administration, a failed administration. The American society is running on fumes, okay, and farts from the leaders they're electing, okay. We have to breathe in the failures of these, you know, and ingest the failures of these idiot leaders that are, you know, thrown upon us, okay, by, you know, and sold to us by millions and millions of dollars put into these primary campaigns or put into presidential elections or even local elections, you know, by totally inept and ignorant, you know, people who cannot lead, but they sure know how to manipulate, you know, or they know how to appropriate, you know, steal, and, you know, do whatever they do. But I mean, the average leader in this country, and we all know it, is a complete and utter imbecile. Okay, those in Washington. I mean, a recent poll I saw was the 18% approval rate for Congress. Yeah, what does that tell you? The American people know how bad it is, but there's nothing they can do about it. They think, well, what they can do is they can think, you know, they can, you know, think for themselves and run for themselves, run against these morons, and, you know, and you'll find there are thousands and millions of people who may vote for you because you speak your mind, right? You're not a puppet. You're not a sold. You're not bought and sold. So be a free thinker, and break away from this web. Break away from this web of senses. You know, these five senses that dominate our existence. We're not. We're simply here to enjoy these senses, to experience these senses. It's part of the holograph that we live in. It's part of the it's part of this third dimensional existence. All right. But if we are to transcend, if we are to evolve, or if we are to ascend to a higher level, a higher existence of human evolution, then we must prepare ourselves to leave this body. Christ said it. God has said it. All the religions said it, say it. All truth of these things. No, we know it. We don't need religions to say it. We all know from experience of seeing other people die, seeing things die, that we too will die. This body will be gone. It may go now, it may go tomorrow, it may go next year, it may last much longer. But it's no different than a car or anything that, you know, it eventually will wear out. And we won't be able to get spare parts. It'd be too old. So, these are things that you have to recognize being in this dimension and being the problems that we face, the soul faces with the senses, the war that is constantly there. And the problem is the soul so easily becomes sedated, all right, seduced, rather than understanding that the soul dictates the terms. It's no different than the people dictate the terms, all right, should dictate the terms. The people of a country, of the world, should be dictating to their representatives, all right, what they expect, what they want. But that's just the reverse that happens. They give up their powers. They give up their ability to think. They join the Democrats or the Republicans. They join, you know, a religion, the Catholics or the Protestants or the Buddhists or the Muslims or whatever, you know, to become, you know, a part of something so they don't have to think. It's already thought out for them, okay? All they have to do is just believe it in complete faith, all right? Which is crock of crap. Believe in yourself. Believe in yourself. Have faith in yourself. You are far greater than anyone out there. Your thoughts are worth more than my thoughts or his thoughts or her thoughts or whatever. They're your thoughts. So cherish those thoughts. Read. Compare. By reading and listening and being taught, you is simply not to absorb in that sense and take on those issues or take on those sentiments or those concepts, but merely to compare what you think to what they think. So the more that you learn and the more that you absorb and hear, okay, then the more you can say, yeah, I agree with that, I don't agree with that, I agree with that. You compare, and that's what education is, true education, analytical. An analytical education is a comparative education. You compare one thing to the next, and you come up with a new solution or a new idea. And that is your mandate. That is what you are here for as a soul or a spirit having a human experience. Okay? And that, I'll end tonight. We have about 41 seconds remaining to our stream. So I wish everybody a good evening, and please join me tomorrow when we, Lila and I, will be joining George Dixon, Friday nights with George Dixon. And I believe we'll be talking about UFOs tomorrow night, certain UFOs and the new revelations that are about to take place in the seventh day of this Mayan calendar, which is coming up in November. So from November to October 2011, we'll be experiencing the seventh day. And good night. been on a longer streaming, and I wish to say join us tomorrow. And tomorrow night at 8, right here with George Dixon.